from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim and Godette, and it's Friday. Time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on all the news amid headlines this week. Our panel today, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports at Idaho Public Television, Sydney Kidd with BoiseDev.com, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Kyle Fonensteel also with the Idaho Capital Sun. Hello, everyone, and surprise to those of you who didn't know, I was here for Gemma today. Hi.
Hey there. Happy Friday.
Hey, Sam.
Hi. Oh, okay, let's get started. Clark, fire. Fire has been big the past, couple months. Oh, my gosh. And so my first question is Highway 21 back open? It was supposed to reopen this morning. Did it? And then why was it closed for a month?
Yeah, it sure did. They reopened Idaho Highway 21 between Loman and Stanley. It had been closed in both directions for a month due to the Wapiti fire, which had been burning in the Boise and the Sawtooth National Forest, and was one of a handful of very large fires that we've had in central Idaho. And so that highway had been closed for a month in both directions. And Highway 21 is really the main way to get between Boise and Stanley. There is another long way to go through Ketchum using Highway 75. But it was a big deal that this had been closed for a month because of the extreme behavior of the Wapiti fire, which had actually jumped the highway and had damaged Highway 21. Damaged the highway itself in certain places. And so Idaho Transportation Department sent out a couple of heads up to go along with the opening this morning. There's going to be some lower speed limits, and there's going to be flaggers on the highway, and there's going to be pilot car escorts through the burned area. It sounds like the Wapiti fire actually burned some of the wooden guardrails and some of the safety features around the highway. So there's going to be, if you're driving out that way, expect to see lower speed limits and flaggers and pilot car escorts, and then they're going to start the process of rebuilding new steel guardrails through those areas. But I think it's going to take just a little while there. They're actually urging folks, if you don't need to go that way, not to make unnecessary trips, and warning people not to stop along the side of the highway there. But it is a big deal. It had been closed for a month, and they were able to successfully open it this morning. I had seen word from the Custer County Sheriff's Office confirming, Sam, that it opened up this morning.
Yeah, and that is a big deal. Anytime we close down any of these highways that pretty much are the only connection, you mentioned there's another way around, but it is forever, as all the ways around are, from our main routes, like a Highway 55 or 21 or 75, one of those. It's just crazy, and it has a lot of impact, especially on those local communities.
Yeah, those local communities, there were areas that were in and out of the evacuation protocol. Well, Idaho has kind of a ready, set, go, sort of a three-tiered approach there. There's businesses up there, you know, in another type of a summer environment. There's a lot of recreation that happens in the Boise National Forest, the Sawtooth National Forest, in and around Stanley and Loman. And so it really changed a lot for so many people. The Wapiti fire and some of these other fires that we can talk about today really made a big impact across Idaho and across the West, really, this summer, Sam.
Let's talk about another wildfire, the lava fire. You went to Cascade, back to Cascade. The Army was at one point called in to fight the lava fire. How's that fire doing? And how come soldiers had to come and help out?
Yeah, for sure. Luckily, with the rain and cooler temperatures that we've had over the last week, that's really helped firefighters get control of both the Wapiti fire. That's why Highway 21 was able to open this morning, but also the lava fire. So we're going to switch gears from Highway 21 to talk about the Highway 55 corridor in the Cascade area, Lake Cascade. Think of it if you're driving up to McCall, up in that area. That fire had gotten so bad, it started September 2nd by lightning. I had actually gone up there in late August and first met some of the 250 U.S. Army soldiers from Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington, who were called in because wildfire resources all across the West were stretched completely thin and were almost non-existent. And so by calling in these 250 firefighters, they were able to add 10 additional fire crews to help out with the more than 1,000 people that were already out there fighting the West Mountain Complex fire, the Boulder fire, and then the lava fire. But that fire was really a concern. It started after some of the fires that were already going on when the soldiers had arrived, and it grew so big that it took over and merged with the Boulder fire, and then it just simply became the lava fire going forward. It reached about 100,000 acres almost. But like I said, luckily, with the rain and the cooler temperatures, it's about 52% contained this morning. But I did have a chance to go to the fire line last week, just before the rain and thunderstorms were arriving. And I got to see the soldiers doing structure protection around houses that had been evacuated, kind of in that southwest tip of Lake Cascade, along Brenda Way and Brenda Drive. And what they had done is hauled about half mile of hoses, Sam, and place them around each of these properties and cabins and structures. And then they walked the hoses down the road, and they used these giant orange inflatable water tanks called pumpkins. And then they connected those to more pumps and hoses and ran that to a creek. So they had this interconnected system of water where they could push and move water around as sort of a last ditch effort to protect homes in the evacuation zone. And so that was one of the last assignments for the soldiers, and I actually got a ride on one of those side-by-side utility vehicles kind of up through that neighborhood into the evacuation zone to see exactly how close the lava fire was to some of those structures. As far as I know, the efforts were all successful, and they didn't have to turn on the hoses themselves. It was kind of a last line of defense that these soldiers helped out with. And then their assignment ended, and they flew home to Washington on Tuesday of this week. It had always planned to be a 30-day assignment. And yeah, they had spent 30 days, and many of them had never fought a wildfire before. I talked to them, and it was the first time that they had done it. And almost every single U.S. Army soldier I talked to, I was able to talk to about a dozen, it seemed like they had gotten a lot out of the mission. They talked about the ability to have an impact back home and to help protect the property and some of the homes that people love in the area. And that was a really rewarding mission for them. A couple of them also talked about getting a chance to go out to have dinner in Cascade and seeing sort of being recognized by locals around town and being able to meet some people and be thanked. And so they were working hard. They told me that it was 12-hour days. They were up since 5 in the morning. They're on the fire line doing physical labor, some of them working with chainsaws or hand tools to kind of clear out vegetation that could burn. Like I said, other people were hauling about a half mile's worth of hoses kind of up and down mountain roads there. And so it was physical, difficult work, but a lot of them said it was really rewarding and that they enjoyed the assignment. But it was pretty rare for the U.S. Army to send in soldiers. But that happened, Sam, because the resources were stretched so thin. With these fires that we hear about in Idaho, and certainly there's big fires right now in California, Sam.
Wow. And it's a great story. So check it out. And Kyle, we're going to move over to the Kumho mine. We've got an update there. Talk about the Kumho Exploration Project. It could turn into an Idaho mine. It's not a mine yet. But first, give us a quick recap. What is this, and what are they looking for? It's that mineral nobody can pronounce.
Yes, thank you for having me, Samantha. And I admit I might stumble over the mineral as well.
Molybdenum. Oh, gosh, I can't ever do it.
Molybdenum is how I've heard it. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right.
Perfect.
But yeah, so for now, the Kumho Exploration Project is just that. It's exploring a possible mine site outside of Idaho City. That city is about 30 miles northeast of Boise. And there are no plans for full-scale mining operations right now. But an early analysis found that the area could have deposits of quite a few minerals, silver and critical minerals that are used in all sorts of different applications like renewable energy and the fight to cope with climate change, national defense, and then some sort of last-ditch efforts to expand drinking water availability. So the company that's proposing the project, the Idaho Copper Corporation, says its goal is to establish itself as one of the world's largest and lowest cost producers of this mineral, molybdenum. And it says it's looking at all factors, including plans to reclaim historic mining damage. a decision on whether it would turn into a full mine would likely be in at least a few years, and it'd require a more comprehensive environmental analysis about any possible effects. But the exploration project is proposed to be 4 years, involving over 100 drill pads and about 9 miles of temporary roads that they say would all be cleaned up and restored within 2 years after the project finishes.
Well, you reported that environmentalists have had some concerns about the mine, but then you mentioned advocates say the minerals could help climate change. So what are some of these concerns?
Yeah, so the big concern that I heard from environmental advocates is that even though it's just a test project right now, even the tests could taint headwaters that feed into the Boise River. That this project is going to be in the mountains outside Boise. And they're skeptical that regulators have really fully identified the possible impacts that this project has had. But the company says that the test project isn't going to harm the Boise River or any watersheds. And again, the Battle of Conservation League says that environmental groups have pushed the U.S. Forest Service, which is tasked with reviewing this mining application. They say they pushed the Forest Service to evaluate impacts that the agency didn't initially look at, like establishing baselines for water quality in the area and a rare secondary bitterroot that's in the project area as well. But the Forest Service says they've factored in all that data on the project reports. And they're taking it into account. So I guess to back up a bit, this mine is part of a broader push for energy security. That essentially involves ramping domestic production in the United States of resources that we typically import from other countries. Many of these resources have applications to deal with the effects of climate change. One mineral that might be at the site, copper, is in high demand for renewable energy systems, including the growing electrical vehicle market. But right now, the United States imports a lot of its copper from overseas. Another metal that the company seeks at the site, called molybdenum, makes steel more resistant to corrosion. That has uses in these desalination plants, which are used in which have been used in South America. They turn salty seawater into potable drinking water. And Gatto Conservation League says they acknowledge the need for these minerals and mining, especially to mitigate climate change's impacts. But they say that communities should have a bigger role in mining plans to avoid potential negative impacts.
And you said the Forest Service, in the story, they could issue an environmental analysis next month, but you mentioned this is a long-term timeline, I think.
Yeah, so I would expect the Forest Service to publish its environmental analysis within the next few weeks, is what I'm hearing. So public comments closed on the environmental assessment on the project, and so the Forest Service is reviewing whether the test project can proceed and responding to these comments. So that next set of reports that'd be released would be a final environmental analysis. But even after that's published, there's still more work to do before a possible approval. These reports coming out, that would start a 45-day objection window. If the project isn't contested, the agency would issue a final decision after then. But if it is objected, those objections could trigger another 45-day review period. So it may take some time until we hear about a possible final approval.
All right, so we'll keep watching. Logan, the Idaho is working on renovations over at the prison to be able to carry out death penalty executions. What is the Department of Correction doing, and how do you know what they're doing? And, you know, a heads up, this is a lunchtime program, and this we are talking about executions, so just a fair warning there. Logan, go.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. I want to give full credit to my colleague Ruth Brown, our writer-producer here at Idaho Reports. She found this information through some building permits that had been filed with the state. And they show that the state of Idaho is doing renovations at the prison, the Maximum Security Institution, which is where the state of Idaho carries out executions for its prisoners that have been sentenced with the death penalty. As folks may recall, back in February earlier this year, the state tried to carry out a lethal injection execution, but was unsuccessful because they were not able to establish an IV line in that gentleman, Thomas Creech. And this, it was kind of ironic that they were not able to establish an IV line, because the last several times they have been wanting to do these lethal injection executions, they haven't been able to get the chemicals and had to cancel them in the past. So the state was finally able to get the chemicals, finally trying to go through with this, and they were not able to establish an IV line to be able to carry out the execution. So Mr. Creech is back on death row, still alive and still living at the prison out south of Boise. So amid all this context of lethal injection chemicals being very difficult to find, the state legislature in 2023 added a second method of execution to the law, allowing the state to use the firing squad to carry out executions. But the thing about that is you need to have a place to do it. So the building permits that Ruth found show that the Department of Correction is retrofitting the F block, which is that section of the prison where the execution chamber is. They have done a phase one, which a spokesperson described to Ruth as modifications to the existing layout, which is nearing completion. And then phase two of the retrofit is going to be layout options for actually being able to accommodate a firing squad out there. And this is a significant step, because earlier this year, around the time that the most recent lethal injection execution was not successful, Director of IDOC Josh Tewalt told legislators that they were actually having trouble finding a contractor who was willing to work with the state to build this potential firing squad facility. So they do appear to have a contractor now, and they've filed these building permits. And Ruth, our reporter, filed a request for the renovation plans, but as far as I know, she has not gotten those back.
Well, and remind us, with Thomas Creech, that was a problem with basically getting the chemicals through an intravenous line. And there's an interesting aspect to this story that Ruth came out with about a central line, and that maybe IDOC wants to go that direction.
Yes. So when IDOC moves to execute a death warrant and carry out a death penalty sentence, there's a very strict, very detailed standard operating procedure that they have to follow. And so that procedure, as it exists in its current form, only allows for access to these peripheral veins. So on the arms, the legs, the hands, the feet. And if I'm remembering right, they tried, I believe it was 8 separate locations on Mr. Creech's body, trying to establish an IV line, and were unsuccessful. And, you know, he's an older guy. They said there were some veins that were collapsed, and it was basically at a point where the state did not feel like they could comfortably carry out this execution without, you know, risking something going wrong. You know, we've heard about botched executions in other states. That was not the situation here. They tried for a while and called it off before things went off the rails, which in my personal opinion was probably a good call from IDOC. So yes, in some court filings, this is actually in court filings from another gentleman who is on death row, Gerald Pizzuto Jr. His attorneys say that Mr. Pizzuto was informed that IDOC is working to amend the execution procedures. And so they believe that IDOC is rewriting those procedures to allow a central line to be established. So rather than just like a regular IV in the arm or the leg, this would be a little bit more invasive procedure, inserting a central line like you would get at a hospital. So this would be a more direct method and likely a more reliable method to be able to administer those chemicals. And this is all based on the court filings. IDOC has not officially updated their execution methods yet, but it appears that the corrections department is working in both of these directions to kind of shore up their ability to carry out lethal injection chemicals when they are able to get the chemicals, and to be able to do death penalty firing squad eventually.
Well, some good work there by Ruth. A good article, too. We'll put more on our website about it. Sydney, you had a story, Boise Dev, on the Union 93 project and how it could end up in foreclosure. First, what is Union 93? And I guess we'll start with, where is it?
Yeah, Sam. So Union 93 is a large mixed-use project. It's located pretty much kitty corner next to Meridian City Hall. And it was planned to be, like I said, a mixed-use project with about 360 residential units. I was going to have some retail space for shops and office space as well.
And some of that structure has been built. It looks a little sort of skeletal, I guess, from the pictures. But it stalled in 2022. You guys have been writing about it. What happened since 2022? There have been a lot of lawsuits and settlements.
Yep. So the reason why the work on the building stalled was because contractors were not getting paid. And so they withdrew and they filed liens on the property. And it's been years of just trying to go to court, get settlements, agree on what is owed. And this week, last week, they kind of came to an agreement with all of the contractors and subcontractors. And at this point, a judge has decided that Galena owes just under $23 million to these contractors.
What happens if Galena can't pay off what it owes? Is that where foreclosure comes in?
Yep. So there's a couple of different avenues that can be pursued now. If they can pay them off, right? And then everything would be settled. But they say that they're close to getting this financing. We're really close. We've worked with it. We have an investor, but they've been telling Boise Dev this for years, that they're close to getting financing. So if they don't actually have it, then what happens is the judge in the case will either find essentially like a real estate agent and have them go and sell the property, or it will be given to the Ada County Sheriff's Office and put up for auction. The property will be.
Wow. Okay, so stay tuned to find out. Okay, Clark and Logan, there is yet another update to the fracas over the old Idaho Transportation Complex in Boise. Clark, before we get to the latest, you had a great timeline in your story yesterday on the whole saga. Can you give us a recap of what's happened so far? And Logan, jump in as we go, because, wow, this has gone on just, it seems like forever.
Fracas is the word, Sam.
That's the word of the day. Go, Clark.
Yeah, it's been going on for quite a bit. I guess we'll start in January 2022 and pick things up from there. But this is a former Idaho Department of Transportation headquarters located on State Street, just a little bit of west of downtown in Boise. But in January of 2022, it flooded, it contaminated with asbestos, and all the employees that were working there were displaced. And then during the next legislative session that year, still in 2022, the Idaho Senate passed House Bill 779, which provided funding and budget intent language saying the people that had been working at this flooded building are going to now be moved to a different space at a different state-owned office complex on Chinden Boulevard. And so a series of things happen at that point, but the Idaho Transportation Department eventually declares the building to be surplus property, saying it's unsuitable for use by ITD. It's made available to other state agencies and nobody claims it. And then so this process begins where the state puts it up for public auction to the highest bidder. The state's moving along and state officials actually tell the legislature's budget committee in November 2023 that they've sold the building to a group of developers for $51.7 million, which was the high bid, which was over the appraised value. But then all of a sudden, during this most recent legislative session, Sam, JFAC, the legislature's budget committee, completely reverses course, and they decide that they're going to block the sale, and that what they want to do is they want to hang on to this flooded, asbestos-contaminated building and renovate it and block the sale. This leads to a lawsuit, which is unsuccessful because the state hadn't actually signed the contract. And so I'm paraphrasing here, but the Idaho Supreme Court said that the high bidders didn't have a legally enforceable right to buy the building. And so the lawsuit was dismissed, but it's already been, as you can tell, coming up on nearly 3 years worth of kind of political disputes and legal wrangling over this property, which has been sitting empty since at least January 2022, following the flood and the contamination there, Logan and Samantha.
Well, and Clark and Logan, I know you both have watched this through the legislature, especially got pretty heated at times. Logan, you were watching this over the past couple of years.
Yes. Yeah, it got pretty heated. It even got a little personal this legislative session. And I think it's fair to say that this disagreement over whether or not to can the sale of the building extended our legislative session this year, probably by a week and a half, if not 2 weeks. And like Clark mentioned, the current state of the building goes back to a flood in January of 2022. But the state was considering selling this land even before that flood. This goes all the way back to 2018, where the state was looking at different state properties that are kind of spread out over the city of Boise, the county of Ada, with the idea of consolidating more of the state functions to their big office complex off of Chinden Boulevard. And the idea there is, you know, you can't charge the state property taxes. And so if we get rid of all of these disparate properties sprinkled throughout the city and the state, then those can go back to private hands. Those can go back on the property tax rolls, maybe be a little bit of tax relief for the citizens. And also just consolidating the functions of state government also helps with a little bit of efficiency. And as Clark mentioned, this has kind of been a bit of a, even though it's been strung out over several years, it's been a bit of a whipsaw back and forth for the transportation department, which is just following the directions of the legislature, which have now swung back the other direction. And the intent of the lawmakers is to renovate this building that has been flooded and move ITD back into that campus.
Okay, so yesterday ITD took back control of the campus. Clark, what happened? Because there was more than just that.
Yeah, for sure. That was part of this legal process. So during the most recent legislative session here earlier in 2024, the legislature set aside $32.5 million as part of that plan that Logan described, where they want ITD back in that building, but they have to renovate it and they have to remove the asbestos contamination. And so in order to spend the money this year, ITD had to take back control of it. Because if you remember in that little summary, we talked about how they declared it surplus property and basically got rid of it. Mm-hmm. So they officially took the property back yesterday. But along with that, they asked staff from the Idaho Transportation Department to work with the Division of Public Works to come up with an estimate, a cost estimate, for what they're really looking at to make that building suitable again. I filed a public records request under the Idaho Public Records Law a couple of weeks ago, and I found out that legislators had basically two options: the $32 million that we talked about to renovate the building and remove the asbestos, or another like $63 million proposal to tear the building down and build a new facility. But I did a little bit of digging, and it turns out that those estimates were developed quickly. They were sight unseen estimates, and they don't take into account the extent of the flood damage or maybe the HVAC repairs that are required. That's what the Department of Administration told me. And so really, as part of taking control back of the building, they're asking for more of a thorough cost estimate of what they're actually looking at to make that building suitable again, remove the asbestos contamination, and then do any kind of flood mitigation, any kind of other work necessary to make it inhabitable after sitting unoccupied for at least, you know, almost 2.5, almost 3 years at this point.
So bottom line, at this point, we don't know if that $32 million is going to be enough that the legislature set aside Right. So we're waiting on a new estimate. What happens if it's not enough? They have to go back to the legislature and say, hey, you know, this, we just can't do it for this amount.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't know. I think that's the big takeaway, is we don't know if the $32.5 million is going to be enough, because it was not a detailed estimate. And so if it's not enough, you're exactly right. We're likely going to be back in front of the Joint Budget Committee, in front of the legislature again, talking about this and debating this, if the $32.5 million is not enough to take care of the asbestos contamination and the flood damage and whatever else may be going on at that State Street property there, Samantha.
So the story is still not over. Okay, we're going to take a break.
Can I hone in on a detail there,
Sam?
Yeah,
come on in.
I want to hone in on that fuzzy $32.5 million number, because it's what was assigned to ITD to start these renovations. Mm-hmm. And the information that it is a sight unseen estimate is interesting, because when the lawmakers were debating over whether or not to kill this sale, it came down to a single vote margin in the Senate. And I personally witnessed, you know, some of the senators sitting on the floor doing back of the envelope math on some of them, like on their phone calculators, trying to figure out whether it was a better deal for the taxpayers to sell the property or to invest this $32.5 million and renovate it, trying to get the best deal for tax dollars that they can. And so if they spent all that time fighting about it and hemming and hawing about whether it was going to break even or make a little bit of money, and if it turns out all of this drama was based on a number that's not based in any actual factual findings, I'm curious how that will tenor that debate when the lawmakers reconvene.
And we should note there will likely be different lawmakers, some of them reconvening, so that could have an impact as well.
Precisely, precisely.
Kyle, you wrote about Idaho's new law regulating pharmacy benefit managers, and I did not know what a pharmacy benefit manager was. Who are they? What do they do? Why are they important?
Yeah. I also didn't know much about pharmacy benefit managers until recently. So pharmacy benefit managers, they're also known as PBMs. They're not quite health insurers. They're essentially middlemen in the pharmacy drug process. They're meant to save drugs by working with other health entities that are part of the process, like health insurers and drug manufacturers, to negotiate costs. But they've been under a lot of scrutiny recently. In July, the FTC released a report saying that PBMs are driving out pharmacy competition and appear to be increasing costs along the way. So in Congress, Idaho's Senator, U.S. Senator Mike Crapo, He's pushed for federal PBM reform that has stalled. His office says Idaho's new law shares many of the goals of federal legislation, but they say that Crapo wasn't involved in Idaho's bill.
Now, our law hasn't taken effect yet. I think you said January 1st. What would it do?
Yeah, so this law takes effect January 1st, and it was passed through House Bill 596 this year's legislative session. It essentially does a few things. It's a long and complicated bill, so this won't be exhaustive, but at a high level, it mandates more transparency from PBMs about their business practices, bans some of those practices, requires some others, and hopefully saves money on drug costs for consumers. The bill does quite a bit of stuff, but just digging in a little bit more, it essentially requires PBMs to publicly report any differences in payment rates to pharmacies and why they might ship the drug up to higher costs here. It also makes PBMs pass through 100% of manufacturer rebates that they get on drugs. And the bill also bans a PBM practice called spread pricing. That's when PBMs charge pharmacy benefit plans a different amount for pharmacy services than the amount that the PBMs actually pay pharmacies. So the bill sponsor, Representative Jordan Redman, he's a Republican from Coeur d'Alene. He said he became involved in this issue after seeing how PBM practices affected the pharmacies that he owned, and he said he talked to rural pharmacists across the state in the process. He says the PBM model, quote, has been effectively perverted into a business model that is just able to harvest money without showing any kind of transparency. And he says it's also contributed to the higher drug cost of pharmacy drugs across the U.S.
Wow. And this is, I will say, a very extensive article. You did a lot of research, talked to both sides. And I think it'll be fascinating to see what happens January 1st. So I would recommend giving this a read. Find out more about PBMs and what they do, because it, as you said, this does it does affect, you know, everybody who goes and gets a prescription at the drugstore. Sydney, we're going to jump over. Your readers wanted to know what was going on at 5 Mile and Lake Hazel. Are we getting a new Dutch Brothers there? Do we know?
It appears that we are getting a Dutch Bros. The county has approved a sign permit for the coffee shop. And also going in that same area is a new AutoZone.
And, you know, this is a little weird. When I saw this article, I thought, okay, you know, great, Dutch Bros, AutoZone, building it up. But this area is outside the norm because you wrote that residents there want more commercial development, which is kind of weird. Is that true?
Yeah, so this area that we're talking about, it's Southwest Ada County, Southwest Boise. There's a lot of suburban sprawl there. And I think we've talked a little bit about this on the show in previous weeks. There's not a whole lot of commercial development going on there. And residents, you're right, they do want more of it. The interesting thing about this area is that sometimes it can be tricky to get commercial developments out there because, number one, businesses don't think they'll profit very much out there. And then number two, sometimes, like with this property, with AutoZone and Dutch Bros, you're limited on what kind of companies you can get to come in here because a lot of places in this area are not able to hook up to the city sewer system, Boise sewer system. Mm. So they have to be able to operate off of a septic system.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting. Well, I think it's fascinating. And we'll have to see what happens in the area and see, you know, if and when the Dutch Bros appears. Clark, you've got about 4 minutes to explain the vote no controversy. Apparently, the Idaho Republican Party is upset because some of their vote no on Prop 1 signs were vandalized. What do we know?
Yeah, it's really comes down to the signs there, Samantha. Earlier this week, the Idaho Republican Party sent out a news release and a couple of columns saying that they had about a dozen of their vote no signs vandalized and defaced in the Meridian and Eagle areas. They sent out a couple of photos that appeared to depict the signs being defaced. One of them, it looked like, was defaced to make it appear that you should vote yes on the proposition, and the other appeared that it was defaced with the image of a swastika on it. And so the Idaho Republican Party announced that they're creating a $5,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest. I reached out to the Idaho Republican Party and some of my contacts there, including Chairwoman Dorothy Moon, to ask if they'd filed a police report or have any other information about a suspect or anything like that. And I haven't heard back. So I'm not aware of any arrest. I'm not aware of any other developments in this case. But it's involving these blue signs that people may have seen along the road or along the highway or online, talking about vote no on Prop 1 ranked choice voting. But they actually have generated a lot of other questions because they depict the state flag and the state seal. And so some folks were wondering if that was allowed. I reached out to the Idaho Secretary of State's office. They said there's limited guidance on the use of the state flag in the state seal in political campaigns and political advertisements, but they don't believe that it's misleading or implying an endorsement on behalf of the state of Idaho. And so they said that they're not going to do anything at this point about the use of the state seal on those signs. So I'm going to continue to kind of keep an eye on that one. We're less than almost about 6 weeks away from election day, but still certainly a developing story there, Samantha. So thanks.
And it's a good story. Check it out. Sydney, there's a ropes course possibly coming to Meridian. It would be part of Vertical View Climbing Gym. I confess, I did not know what a ropes course was, but you've got 3 minutes to explain to me what it is, and you've got some pictures on the website of what it might look like.
Yeah, so when I think of a ropes course, I often think of it as like a jungle gym, but adventure. So what you're going to see with that is a lot of climbing elements. You're going to see some kind of like twisty rope bridges, and the participants are hooked on to the structure with cables. So there's some zip line features that are going to be on this. There's just a lot going on, really. And it's supposed to be 4 levels. It's if you've gone up to Bogus Basin in the summertime, they have a ropes course out there. Hmm. There's one inside of Wahoos, like when you first walk in. And then there's another one at Bodies in Motion. So Vertical View has submitted permit work with the city. They would still need to get that approved for this to come to pass. But that's kind of what they're hoping to get done here.
Well, and you mentioned it was 4 levels. That's pretty high. And there's like a kid's side to this.
Yeah, so the kid's side's on the first level. And then as you go up, I think it's probably gets progressively more challenging. But yeah, where it's 4 levels, you'll definitely be grateful for that harness system holding you into the ropes course, I would think.
I would think so. And it's got zip lines, which I think we're more familiar with, and then a free fall jump, which sounds a little daring, but who knows?
Yeah, sure does. yeah, if you want to see the renderings of it, we have pictures of it up on our website, boisedev.com.
And you mentioned this would be in addition to the Vertical View Climbing Gym. This would be outside. So the ropes course would be outside.
Yes. Yep, the ropes course would be outside on the east side of the property. And then inside, obviously, you still have all of the climbing walls, the bouldering walls, the group fitness centers. Lots going on at Vertical View.
Thanks for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Samantha Wright. We'll see you tomorrow.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.